It appears that he, though, tried to apply some pressure on my behalf, and this was without ever discussing it with me.
Governor Palin releases documents from her administration's investigation of Walt Monagan's firing. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 13th of August. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a grant to provide more cancer screenings in Kodiak.
We want to identify symptoms and conditions through these screenings because they can significantly reduce the incidence of cancer through early intervention and treatment.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Harvesting wild game is extremely important to many Alaskans, not only as a food source, but as a long-standing traditional practice. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game is committed to maintaining healthy caribou and moose populations. To learn more about the principles and guidelines behind predator management, visit wildlife.alaska.gov or contact your local fish and game office. This message is sponsored by the State of Alaska, Department of Fish and Game.
Governor Palin today made public some of the documents the Department of Law has accumulated during its internal investigation of the firing of former Public Safety Commissioner Walt Monagan. The department is investigating the firing to determine if there was undue pressure on Monagan and others in his department to fire State Trooper Mike Wooten. Palin says some of her staff's contacts with Monagan could have been taken as coming at her direction, although she says she did not authorize them. In announcing the results of the administration's inquiry, the governor said it showed that her staff contacted the department 24 times over the Wooten issue over the months, and she thought that many were appropriate. But she says they were not at her request, and she did not know about them.
However, the serial nature of the contacts understandably could be perceived as some kind of pressure, presumably at my direction, because, namely, specifically, most disturbing is a telephone recording apparently made and preserved by the troopers in February documenting a call that was placed by a department or to a Department of Public Safety manager by my boards and commissioners director, Frank Bailey.
In the recorded phone conversation, she says that Bailey referred to Wooten's firing as something that, quote, Sarah wants.
I've repeatedly said that Trooper Wooten played no part in the dismissal of Walt Monagan, and I stand by that. Mr. Bailey was aware of my family's personal concerns about Trooper Wooten. It appears that he, though, tried to apply some pressure on my behalf, and this was without ever discussing it with me. And I apologize to Alaskans for this distraction.
Palin says there were many reasons that Monagan was fired, from the department's not making progress in meeting key goals that had been set at the beginning of the administration to his not being what she called a team player on budget cuts from her office. Bailey is still employed as the governor's director of boards and commissions, although Palin says she's consulting advisors on whether any personnel action should be taken. Another investigation is underway by the Legislative Council to determine whether the governor or her staff abused their power in firing Monagan. Senate Judiciary Chairman Hollis French says the legislative investigation will welcome the governor's evidence.
It certainly appears as if the independent investigation is having its intended effect. It's causing the administration to take a look at their own records, gather evidence, and now they've suddenly discovered that there appears to be something like a dozen phone calls from different sources to Commissioner Monagan, putting pressure on him to get rid of Trooper Wooten.
Steve Branchflower was appointed to lead the Legislative Council investigation. French says Branchflower is in the process of collecting his own evidence and talking to witnesses. Representatives from Arctic nations are gathered in Fairbanks for a conference to discuss health, climate change, and energy in the region. Alaska U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski opened the 8th Conference of Parliamentarians of the Arctic yesterday at the University of Alaska Fairbanks by stressing the United States' changing perspective on the Arctic.
I often fight an uphill battle with some of my colleagues in the Congress, reminding them of the importance of the Arctic. But I believe as the world looks for new ways to adapt to climate change and for new sources of energy, most certainly, I think this perception will begin to change, and I believe begin to change very quickly.
Alaska Governor Sarah Palin also addressed Arctic parliamentarians. Palin talked of what she called Alaska's nearly endless supply of energy resources and the importance that they be developed. She said the debilitating cost of energy in rural Alaska is strangling Alaska Native villages.
To the point of subsistence hunting and fishing becoming too expensive to continue. It's fair to say that the current energy crisis is placing the culture and the very way of life of Alaska Natives in peril. So it is imperative that we look to developing new local energy technologies for these communities in order to break that dependence on expensive imported energy sources.
Governor Palin says decisions on development in the state should be left up to Alaskans, who she says are best entrusted to do so responsibly. She expressed interest and respect for creative ideas and technology of other Arctic nations. Chair of the Inuit Circumpolar Council, Patricia Cochran of Nome, says she's concerned that Arctic people are being overstepped as the world looks north for resources.
Unfortunately, we've had certainly some of those issues, and we are trying to organize ourselves so that we have more of a vocal community, more of an organized community, not only in the Arctic, to be quite honest with you, but truthfully on an international scale now.
Cochran is heading up organization of an international conference of indigenous peoples on climate change that's scheduled for next spring in Anchorage. The Fairbanks conference runs through tomorrow. Representatives from the U.S., Canada, Denmark, Greenland, Iceland, Finland, Norway, Sweden, and Russia are in attendance. A federal grant is helping the Native Association in Kodiak offer more cancer screenings for patients. KMXT's Mary Donaldson has more.
Kodiak Area Native Association, or CANA, received $100,000 in federal grant money for cancer screening initiatives from the Indian Health Service. Anita Baylor, CANA's finance director, says this is the third year CANA's received the grant.
The overall goal of the grant was to increase cancer screenings, because if you increase screenings, hopefully you would catch things at an earlier stage, so treatment would be easier.
Tammy Hansen is CANA's health director and says the grant money will be used to increase early cancer screenings.
One of the indicators that has been identified as a priority this year is increasing the number of early cancer detection screenings that we conduct. So we're going to use this grant funding to provide nurse case management services for our patients. And in addition to the tracking and reporting requirements that we will meet with this position, CANA's case managers will take a proactive role to ensure that early cancer screenings are conducted so that we can detect and possibly even prevent cancer earlier on. This grant's also going to be used to fund certain screening exams that are not available at CANA, such as mammograms and colonoscopies.
Baylor says these kinds of screenings are important, especially for Native populations.
Alaska Native people have higher numbers for cancers of these types than nationally. So it was kind of just a focus that we wanted to get in on. We focused on Pap tests and colorectal screenings and breast self-exams, and, you know, we want to increase all of those things that people should be doing but maybe aren't, and we just want to get them into the doctor to get them done.
Hansen says increasing these services through the grant will hopefully lower cancer rates or make detection and treatment a little easier.
We felt that this grant was important because we want to identify symptoms and conditions through these screenings because they can significantly reduce the incidence of cancer through early intervention and treatment. So CANA would like to just encourage everyone to talk to their doctors about what early cancer screenings might be right for them.
Providence Health System was also awarded $948,000 for rural health outreach initiatives, while the Providence Alaska Medical Center was awarded almost $190,000 for rural outreach initiatives. I'm Mary Donaldson.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, new evidence of the ancient shoreline in Southeast.
If at that time you and I would have lived to be 40 or 50 years of age, the sea level would have risen 6 to 8 feet during our lifetime.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Tech Kaminko and the Red Dog Mine, encouraging listeners to tune into AK every weekend. Check your local public radio station for airtimes.
The U.S. Bankruptcy Court for the District of Alaska has set a deadline for filing claims for anyone who has been sexually abused or injured by priests or anyone working for the Fairbanks Diocese. The deadline is December 2, 2008. Claim forms are available online at dioceseoffairbanks.org or by calling 1-888-570-6269. This message is sponsored by the Catholic Bishop of Northern Alaska.
The crimes people commit while driving are the impetus for a new state position called a traffic safety resource prosecutor. Deputy Attorney General Rick Savodny says more than half the states already have traffic prosecutors. He says the number of traffic-related prosecutions warrants the job. Nationwide, an average of 43,000 people die each year in traffic crashes of all kinds. Savodny says in Alaska, in just 1 year, 2006, 43 people were killed and many more injured.
We have a lot of traffic fatalities that are caused by alcohol or drugs. We've become pretty experienced in prosecuting people for DUIs, but the combination of alcohol and drugs, the drugs have become substantially more of a problem for us, and they're more difficult to prosecute. And it's time that we develop the expertise in that area.
Savodny says drug-related traffic crimes are more difficult to prosecute than alcohol because the amount of alcohol in the system can be measured. Assistant District Attorney David Brower has been named to the position. Savodny says Brower will be a statewide coordinator for policies on impaired driving and other traffic crimes.
He'll be doing training both for state prosecutors, municipal prosecutors across the state. He will be available for all police departments to deal with questions about these types of offenses. He'll be dealing with the state crime lab in making sure that our policies to detect drugs and use intoximeters to determine alcohol levels are working properly and basically be a resource for both prosecution and police.
Brower has been a prosecutor in both rural Alaska and Juneau, where he handles a variety of cases. Savodny says the job will be located in Juneau. Researchers looking for evidence of early human migration along Alaska's southeastern coast probably have been looking in the wrong place. Recent geological studies suggest that the island's coves and beaches that later became home to contemporary Native cultures likely did not exist when the forebears of those cultures first moved into North America from Asia around 30,000 years ago. At the annual Paths Across the Pacific conference held last month in Sitka, scholars considered how deposits of seashells, sometimes found high in the mountains of Southeast, provide clues to an ancient shoreline that may have been the home of the first Americans. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
Forest Service geologist Jim Bachtel was among the first to realize that Southeast Alaska was not completely buried by glaciers during the last ice age. Animal and now human remains found in the extensive cave systems on Prince of Wales Island demonstrate that there were habitable areas where life thrived over 10,000 years ago. But this is scant evidence to build a new theory of human migration on. Until recently, geologists have assumed that because so much water was locked up in the glaciers during the Ice Age, sea levels were about 300 feet lower than today. What would have been Alaska's coastline, they believed, where people would have lived and gathered and hunted, is now deep under the ocean. But Bachtel and other geologists for the last few years have been exploring something that may turn that idea on its head. They're called raised marine shell beds. Bachtel has found seashells all over Southeast Alaska, 1,000 feet above present sea level in Juneau and 400 feet above present sea level near Wrangell and Petersburg. Here's how Bachtel explained it to the Paths Across the Pacific conference in Sitka.
The weight of the ice is so immense when it moves out on the land that it pushes down on the land. When the ice retreats, the sea invades the land and the land bounces back up. These deposits were laid down when the sea invaded the land and now are found above modern sea level today.
The phenomenon of glacial rebound is still going on today, but the rate of uplift is minuscule and it hasn't really factored into the search for the earliest Americans. The raised marine shell beds, Bechtel believes, indicate that the rate of glacial rebound at one time may have been staggering. He puts up a slide of an aerial photograph to prove his point.
So if you wanted to look for a cultural site that was somewhere in the 8,200-year range, you would want to be walking this old paleo shoreline around here and not looking down where the shoreline is today.
Bechtel called the search for the earliest cultural sites in Southeast like finding a needle in a haystack. But at least the anthropologists and archaeologists attending the PATHS conference now know where the haystack is. Despite the evidence that areas of Southeast paleo shoreline may actually be far above current sea level, Bechtel said that rising ocean levels did factor into where people might have lived. Citing data from ocean core samples taken around the Queen Charlotte Islands, it looks like the seafloor near the continental shelf may have been dramatically higher at one time. Bechtel puts up another slide that shows what Southeast Alaska's coast may have looked like 14,000 years ago, with vast swaths of land extending in front of the glacial walls. Some of our favorite halibut holes, he tells Sitkins in the audience, may have been islands. As the glaciers began to recede, the bulges dropped, and the oceans began to rise rapidly. Early Americans living on the bulge would have moved. Bechtel believes the ocean rise could have been as much as 5 centimeters a year.
And if at that time you and I would have lived to be 40 or 50 years of age, the sea level would have risen 6 to 8 feet during our lifetime.
But despite relocating often, the earliest Americans may not have had it too bad in Southeast Alaska. Bechtel says that fish bones found in the Prince of Wales caves with the remains of small mammals were Pacific sardines. Climate data and ancient charcoal suggests that the temperature may have been about 4 degrees Celsius warmer on average, with half as much precipitation. Forest fires may have been part of the ecology. Bechtel says that life for those first coastal Americans, if we ever find where they lived, may have been a day at the beach. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
The Fort Knox mine has begun construction of a heap leach facility. The state's largest gold mine received state and federal permits for the operation a year ago. It involves percolating a cyanide solution through massive piles of low-grade ore to liberate gold. The gold-saturated liquid is then collected in an underlying liner. Fort Knox environmental manager Delbert Parr says 129 acres were cleared earlier this summer for the project.
We're currently constructing access roads, building a carbon plant to recover the gold from the solution generated by the heap leach process, just finishing up the embankment or the dam that will hold the in-heap storage pond.
The facility is being constructed to be zero discharge to the environment. The heap leach process is not currently employed anywhere else in Alaska and has a checkered environmental history in the lower 48. Heap leaching is banned in the state of Montana. The Fort Knox project underwent extensive government and public review and is designed around the latest leak protection technology. Parr says it features a special Arctic-grade plastic liner.
80 mils in thickness. Much more flexible and much more conducive to the cold climates than the HDPE that's been used in most other operations in the more southern parts of the country.
Parr says the liner is doubled up in areas where cyanide solution will pool. The entire facility is located upstream of the mine's tailings pond and dam as an extra protection. It's designed to extract gold from ore that's too low grade to economically run through the mine's processing mill. Parr says Fort Knox already has 30 million tons of ore stockpiled.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the University of Alaska College Savings Plan, providing tax-advantaged college savings options for Alaska families. T. Rowe Price Investment Services Incorporated, distributor, underwriter. Information at 1-888-4, and then Alaska. And by
the State of Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Information about the state's predator management program is available on the web at wildlife.alaska.gov.
Tiny to Titlick in Prince William Sound will benefit from high-speed telecommunications and internet service thanks to a $1 million Community Connect grant from USDA Rural Development. The grant is one of 25 awarded to rural communities across the U.S. to provide broadband service where none had previously existed. Dave Dengle is chief executive of Copper Valley Telephone Cooperative, the recipient of the grant. Copper Valley will use the grant to install a microwave link between Valdez and Titlick.
It operates over radio. It's a radio frequency, but it's better than the satellite link that we have now into some of our villages and into Titlick. We'll be able to provide them that higher speed internet access over using radio waves. And we have several microwave links within our service area, and there's other large telecommunication carriers in the state that use microwave to transport calls and internet between Anchorage and the rest of the state.
High-speed internet service could open a door to health and educational opportunities for Titlick residents. Dengle says the grant provides free services to vital community hubs as well.
We agreed that if we received the grant, that we would provide free internet access to the clinic and to this community center for 2 years. And we also have to provide at the community center 10 computer terminals for 2 years, as well as provide a salary for a coordinator to help the folks out in Titlick with any questions they might have on using the internet and using their computers and things like that.
Dengle says the new system will be operational in late 2009. The summer ferry schedule is out for review. That's next summer's ferry schedule. Officials say the early release should help passengers and tour groups plan for next year's busy season. The 2009 summer schedule is much the same as this season's operating plan. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld has the report.
Lawmakers and local leaders slammed marine highway managers last year for their late release of the summer schedule. They said the timing made it hard for teachers and coaches to plan school trips, and some said it hurt lodges and other tour operators dependent on ferry traffic. The Marine Highway usually waits until its budget is out before telling riders about its operating plan. Ferry Chief Jim Beadle, who took over the job in the spring, says this earlier release is a first.
We've been working very well with the governor's office, Office of Management and Budget, on getting a pre-approval before the budget process. The governor doesn't even need to submit her budget to the legislature until December 15th. But we have worked with them and got approval to go forward with this summer schedule that is going to allow us to get, sometime in October to have the summer schedule open for bookings.
The fall, winter, spring operating plan was also released early this year before the end of July. That schedule is available for bookings. The draft 2009 summer schedule is much the same as this season's operating plan. The mainliner Columbia will continue weekly service from Bellingham to Southeast. The fast ferry Fairweather will run from Juneau to Sitka 5 days a week and to Petersburg 2 days a week, and the Matanuska will connect Prince Rupert to Ketchikan, Wrangell, Petersburg, and Points North. Ferry Operations Director Chuck Van Kirk says the idea is to give riders consistency.
We've been saying now this is the second year of a three-year schedule that we've told people that we would try to keep it consistent for that period of time. And that gives us and our marketing folks the opportunity to really assess what the impacts of schedule change are.
Next summer's draft schedule also calls for the Malaspina to continue sailing from Skagway to Haines and Juneau on a daily basis. The Lekondi will still be on its northern southeast village route, and the Kennecott will sail in southeast and across the Gulf half the time and be tied up the other half. Minor changes are proposed for next year for the Malaspina, the Lekondi, the Chenega, and the Tustamina. Full schedule details are available online through the ferry system's website. Marine Highway Chief Jim Beadle says he and other officials will listen to suggestions from communities and residents before finalizing the plan. A teleconference hearing is planned for Thursday, August 14th. Southeast suggestions will begin at 10 a.m. and Southwest comments will be taken at 1:30 p.m. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Juneau.
Alaska fiddle musician, poet, and book author Ken Waldman is back in the state after an East Coast tour promoting the simultaneous release of his 7th CD and his 7th book. Although the prolific writer has mainly published collections of poetry in the past, his new book, Are You Famous? Touring America with Alaska's Fiddling Poet, is autobiographical in nature. Waldman says he's trying to answer the questions he's asked about why and how he tours the nation playing his fiddle.
How do you get your jobs? Or how do you do this? Or why do you do this? Or, you know, so in a sense, I've kind of in the last month or two, I can, if I'm having a longer conversation, I go, we can talk about this, but here, just read the book.
And the latest CD, this is...
It's called 55 Tunes, 5 Poems. I mean, I had the CD, one of the CDs before that, all originals, all traditionals, tunes I made up and traditional tunes. This is... Couldn't be more literal. It's 55 tunes, 5 poems, but there are 5 bonus tunes and 5 bonus poems. So it's actually 60 tunes and 10 poems.
So a lot of the names on here are familiar Alaska names. Are there any on here that really stand out to you that are sort of like favorites or?
The first tune on the first side is one called, I call it Old 55. You know, it's like, okay, I got 55 tunes. I like that tune. It's a rockin' tune. A friend of mine in Louisiana heard it and said, I want to learn that tune. And he's somebody who has his particular tastes. And he said, I'll play that A tune, even though it's not cross-tuned, you know. I like that one. There's a waltz in there called Waltz Into the Light that I really like, that I've been playing. It came out, Mark said something. He said, I'll get a CD and I'll only like one or two tunes. And of those 60... I like 12 of them, and that's like, I was like kind of, I think, high praise. And he said, there are 12 tunes that I would learn and play. This is a guy who played on the CD, but, you know, he was there, and they were there and gone. But he said, there are tunes I would play. So that was nice.
Ken Waldman, Alaska's Fiddling Poet, will be playing tonight at Alice's Champagne Palace in Homer. Tomorrow night he'll be at Tidal Wave in Anchorage, and on the 16th he'll be at Anchorage's Taproot Cafe. More on his work is on our website, aprn.org. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Mary Donaldson in Kodiak, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Rosemary Alexander and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, and Robert Woolsey in Sitka. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau and Ellen Lockyer from Anchorage. Our producer and editor is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. Our intern is Eli Menneker. John Prophet is our webmaster. Our managing editor is Duncan Moon. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by...
The Rasmussen Foundation, accepting applications from Alaska artists for project awards. The deadline is September 1st.
The State of Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Information about the state's predator management program is available on the web at wildlife.alaska.gov.
And by...
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983. On the web at arcticwirerope.com.
9 out of 10 of Alaska's boating fatalities are adult males. Most drowned following an unexpected fall or capsize into cold water. Cold water can kill the unprepared, regardless of swimming ability. Wearing a life jacket can make the difference between life and death. Make your family's boating memories good ones. Always wear a life jacket when boating Alaska's cold water. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.